Good afternoon. Go ahead and call the Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February the 6th. It is now 1:35. Members present are Representative Munoz, Representative Holmes, Representative Guerra, Representative Costello, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Thompson, Representative Newman. Today, OMB will be presenting the supplemental budget, and then the Department of Law will come up on their overview. So, Mr. Rayfield, if you want to come forward and introduce yourself and present the supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Karen Rayfield, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and give you an overview of the supplemental bill that was read across yesterday, I believe, House Bill 299. Of course, the supplemental is for those unanticipated events that occur after the budget is signed last spring. I have with me today our Chief Budget Analyst, Kelly O'Sullivan, and also some reinforcements from the departments in the event there are some detailed questions about a specific item that I'm unable to answer. We have two documents for your consideration today. I have a supplemental summary, a one-page document, and then an eight-page spreadsheet. And the spreadsheet is in supplemental bill section and line number. So if that's your desire, Mr. Chairman, we'll just go through the spreadsheet and talk about the items. Just generally, though, I can tell you that the total supplemental bill in front of you totals $53,370,100. And at a high level, less than $1 million of that is specific to agency operations. Almost $48 million is specifically related to fire suppression activities and disaster relief funding. Nearly $2 million in settlements and judgments that have been negotiated, and about $2.4 million in emergency repairs that were not eligible for disaster funding. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I can start with the spreadsheet. The supplemental bill has 17 sections in it. I think we can move through this fairly quickly.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So on the page one of the spreadsheet, I'll start on line two, which is our first operating item requested, and it's for the Department of Administration Office of Public Advocacy. We're requesting $193,000 general fund to address caseload capacity issues and also their appellant backlog. I think the committee is very familiar with both the Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender Agency because we've worked very hard over the last couple of years to make adjustments in those budgets so that they can manage to the dollar amount appropriated. Their caseloads continue to increase and their backlog as well. We are considering both of these items on lines 2 and 3 of the spreadsheet for a potential budget amendment that I know is due to your committee here on the 30th day. Under the Public Defender Agency, again, this a similar situation where their caseload and their appellant backlog has increased. So we're requesting $650,000 of general funds for the Public Defender Agency. On line 4 of the spreadsheet for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs under the Alaska Military Youth Academy, we're asking for a fund source change. And this is specific to the GGU lump sum payment that was approved last year. We have two components of their funding for that particular lump sum payment that were not realizable, interagency receipts and federal receipts, so we're asking for a fund switch to general funds of $48,000 to make that one-time payment. On line 5 is for the Department of Natural Resources. This has to do with the fire suppression activity. The total request you'll see on that line is $22,769,400. These are for the fires from last spring and fall. This is the state's portion of the firefighting costs. We do have federal partners that participate in fighting fires on both federal and state lands. The Department of Natural Resources works with those agencies on determining the amount that the state will pay versus the amount that the federal government will pay. This is the request, and I know that the legislature is apprised as the fire season continues, so that you know what fires they're working on and fighting and the estimated costs. Mr. Chairman, on lines 6 and also 7 and 8 of the spreadsheet, these are other fund requests specifically to the Division of Treasury and the Department of Revenue, having to do with investment management fees. These fees are charged as a percent of the market value of the invested assets. So on line 6, you'll see a $19,000 request for the management fees related to the public school trust fund. On lines 7, you'll see $7,000 requested for management of the retiree health insurance fund. And on line 8, $16,000 for the management of the power cost equalization fund. And those are the operating numbers sections of the supplementals requested. Turning to capital items on page 2, line 11 of the spreadsheet, you'll see a request for $500,000 that would be a named recipient grant to the Inner Island Ferry Authority. As you know, this is the entity that provides service to Prince of Wales Island in southern southeast Alaska. We have, over the past several years, provided some assistance to the Inner Island Ferry Authority to keep this transportation link running. And the request we also have included in the governor's FY15 request before you. On line 12, under the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, we're requesting $2,408,100 in general funds, and these are for emergency repairs in due to flooding, ice jams, and other events which resulted in substantial damage but were not eligible for reimbursement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. In the packet or the backup materials for the project, you'll see a list of the items and the repairs that were made by DOT. So those are requested for your consideration. Then, Mr. Chairman, jumping to the language section of the supplemental bill, starting on page 3 of the spreadsheet, you'll see on line 16 for the Department of Environmental Conservation, we're requesting a reappropriation of the unobligated, unexpended balance of a number of projects that were either completed under budget or were not able to start for one reason or another, estimated to be a little over $3.3 million. The request is to reappropriate those funds to the Village Safe Water Program to continue to do work on some of the first-time service projects. On line 17, section 6B of the supplemental request, there's a scope change requested for a project in Haines for the Barnett water tank replacement. We would like to also, as part of that project, repair the Tower Road water tank roof. So there's funding within that existing appropriation. It just requires a scope change to make that happen. On line 18, under the Department of Health and Social Service, we're requesting the reappropriation of approximately $81,000 from the eligibility information system evaluation to the replacement project itself. So $81,000 for that. On line 19, for the Department of Law, you will see in section 8A, a request for $1,570,200 related to judgments and settlements that we have received to date. There are four of them in this particular item. On line 20, section 8B is language that you've seen before. Once for for any settlements or judgments that come in between the time the legislature adjourns and the end of this fiscal year, we would be able to pay those so we don't incur more interest expense over the year. So that's language that we typically put forward. We will, of course, if there are other judgments that and settlements reached while you're still in session, we'll be bringing those forward so you'll know what those are. On page 4, line 21, Mr. Chairman, this is for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and this is the reappropriation of approximately $350,000 for projects at the Alcantara base, there for some covered storage areas. On line 22, again for Military and Veterans Affairs, an estimate of $195,000 to be reappropriated for Eielson Air Force Base for some covered storage there as well. And on line 23 for Military and Veterans Affairs, there is a settlement having to do with an arbitration related to the Alaska Military Youth Academy of $111,300. So that would be able to pay that arbitration settlement. On page 5, line 24, there is language that we have used in the past regarding fire suppression, again, because we know that between the time the legislature adjourns and June 30, April, May, and June can be a busy fire season in Alaska. So we have a request estimated to be $5 million for costs incurred through that period of time. On line 25, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, this is another settlement agreement of $164,600. It has to do with contaminated site cleanup at the old Quinnagoc Airport. I believe it was removal of a facility there, and there were hazardous substances that needed to be cleaned up, and that's part of the settlement of that that work. On line 26, there is a request in the Office of the Governor under the section that has to do with the fuel trigger. And the fuel trigger is, has been a very effective tool that the legislature included in the budget several years ago so that we didn't actually put more money into a department's base budget, but we twice a year allocate funding based on an analysis of their fuel and utilities costs. In the current year, what we're looking at is the University of Alaska. Of course, they're one of our larger departments in terms of the fuel allocation because of the number of facilities that they have statewide. It's projecting a shortfall of about $1.6 million in their total fuel and utility costs for this year. What we're proposing here is to increase the percentage of the university's allocation of the fuel trigger. So that will particularly in the area of DOT, where their statewide facilities, equipment, fuel funding, and then the Marine Highway may have more than they need in the current fiscal year. So we're continuing that analysis, but we believe there's sufficient funding within the current fuel trigger appropriation to increase the allocation to the university and cover their costs. So you'll see the request to change that percentage in the language. On lines 27 and also on 28, you'll see some fund switches having to do with debt service on a couple of different state bond issuances. It has to do with, on line 27, you'll see there's a fund switch for a shift from federal dollars, federal era funds that are not available to general fund to cover those bond issuance, and then on 28, you'll see the reverse happening where general funds are being swapped for federal funds. So between, it's a kind of a cleanup between the debt service funding for those two bonds. On 29 and 30, you will see fund source changes requested under the International Airport revenue bonds. That we typically see that this time of year. The International Airport looks at their funds and their accounts and makes specific requests to us to adjust fund sources to, of course, minimize the costs that they're passing on to the the consumers there at the airports. On line 31, you'll see a request for $19,961,500 for the Disaster Relief Fund, and you know that's the process that we go through of determining the disasters, what's eligible for funding. The legislature is, of course, kept informed as those disasters occur and as expenditures are made. So this actually capitalizes what we've taken from that fund. On page 7, line 32, this is new language for your consideration, but similar to what we've talked about under fire suppression, where we really don't know what kind of events may occur between now and the end of the current fiscal year with flooding and spring breakup and other things that happen. This would provide some authorization for us to address those within this supplemental language, and we don't have a good number, an estimate. We just simply don't know. But we'd still follow the process, the statutory process for declaring as a disaster and getting the information to the legislature. On line 33, there are several ratifications that are requested. The ratifications are listed at the end of the spreadsheet from lines 41 on page 7 all the way through to on page 8, line 52. And those ratifications are for terminated appropriations. They're for prior year, typically an over-expenditure where your federal funds were unrealizable or some cost was disallowed, but those are expenditures that occurred previously. When we ask for your consideration of a ratification, it helps us what we call zero balance the appropriation. Those have already taken place. In the description of the ratification, it will tell you what fiscal year, because some of these are from, you'll see from fiscal year 12, fiscal year 9, fiscal year 10. It's a wide range, but they're all closed out fiscal years. So this helps us clean up the accounting of those old terminated expenditures. On line 34, 16A, section 16A, provides the capital lapse for specific appropriations regarding the DEC, HESS, and Military and Veterans Affairs requests before you. On 16B, line 35, that is for capitalization. Section 14 is for capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund, so it does not lapse. And then line 36 is the effective date of the bill, which would be the last day of session, April 20th, 2014. And with that, Mr. Chairman, those are the requests for your consideration.
Okay, thank you. Member questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question on the fire suppression. So the major fire that was in Fairbanks this year was caused by another entity. Are we recouping those costs from that entity?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, my understanding is that the majority of that fire was on federal lands, and when you see in the backup, you'll see the total amount of the fire costs. Those are being recouped from the federal government.
Follow up?
So
not just on the federal, but I mean there was private land that was hit as well as state land that also is being recouped.
That's my understanding.
Just want to make sure.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Rehfeld. On fire suppression, I don't know what other regions of the state. I know we're under watch right now, and it usually doesn't happen in early February that we're under fire concerns because of lack of snowpack, and Palmer has legendary wind as well and other factors. But the fire danger this year, have you talked to Commissioner Balash and his people about some of the things we may be facing? You can't predict a fire, but especially when they're in a more urbanized area, you have to go to more heroic measures than you're trying to save somebody's recreational cabin or somebody's corporate land or others. has there been discussion about how intense this problem could be? And we had a fire in Palmer right now. It would be pretty severe.
Co-Chair Stoltz, absolutely. I think the Department of Natural Resources can talk with you about, well, first, they're very much their concerns, because we've seen the last several fire seasons have been very significant. What they are doing in terms of their ability to mitigate to the extent possible, to train local crews, there's a number of efforts that they're undertaking within their budget to try to do as much as they can, but I think they have a high level of concern about fire danger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Eiffelt, on the capital line item 11, you said that this same FY14 request is also in the FY15 budget. Is it into the capital request for FY15?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is a capital request, and if I might just add, it's not been our intention to make this an annual operating expense of the state of Alaska. Where we've come to with the Inter-Island Ferry Authority is recognizing that they provide a vital service to Prince of Wales Island, recognizing that if they were not able to provide the service, it's entirely possible the Marine Highway would need to take that back on, and the complexity of doing that and also the cost of doing that would be, I think, something that we need to spend some time considering before we went down that path. The Inter-Island Ferry has, over the past several years, made some pretty significant modifications to their operations to try to be able to operate without state assistance. In this current fiscal year and next, we've looked at their financials. We believe that they could use some assistance to help keep them going, but it's not, and we've been very clear with them, that we're not entertaining making them just carte blanche to part of the annual state budget.
This is a request we turned down last year when they came it forward in our budget, and now you're coming back and asking for it to be added to the FY14. In our conversations with them last year, they were providing 7-day-a-week service to Prince of Wales Island from Ketchikan with their own private interagency or inter-ferry service. We felt that providing 7-day-a-week service and then coming to the state and saying we can't afford to do this anymore, we need help from the state. Our question was, why don't you reduce service and keep your costs down a little bit? I'm not so happy about seeing this in this budget. I'm not so happy about seeing it in the FY15 budget for $1 million worth of supplemental operating cost for something that's not a state entity. And particularly since, as you know, Kodiak, we receive service twice a week, and we're very happy. A lot more population on Kodiak Island than there is in Prince of Wales. And so I'm having a hard time with this one, and I'm probably going to not support this going through unless I can hear something from Inter-Island Ferry Service saying that they are controlling their costs, they're becoming more efficient, they're cutting back service that they can't afford to provide.
Mr. Chairman,
basically you were sending our ferry to Prince of Wales or Prince Rupert to pick up people this summer and not providing service to Kodiak Island except once a week and sometimes not even that. Yet you're requesting us to provide 7-day-a-week service to Prince of Wales Island. So there's something miscued in the system that we have here that's not quite quite right for me. So,
Mr. Chairman, only, and clearly I understand your concerns as well. I think part of the challenge is that we have the Marine Highway system providing statewide service and some of the issues with stability there and an aging fleet and some of the challenges that we've had, and then a separate system, the Inter-Island Ferry, not part of the Marine Highway, with basically one run that they're trying to generate enough revenue to keep them sailing, which is part of the reason, I think, of their schedule, even though they have made some cutbacks. But I think it will be incumbent upon the Inter-Island Ferry to talk with you about that. Again, our concern is that we're concerned about if the Inter-Island Ferry is not able to provide service, to what degree the state of Alaska through the Marine Highway System would need to go in and reinstate that service and what that cost would look like. So we're having those discussions, but I think it will be complicated.
I understand that, and I understand the issues dealing around trying to control our own spending and our own budget and how the angst has been in this committee about having to go in and look at what the efficiencies of our own departments are and trying to control those costs and bring them down. So, again, I'm just going to have a very difficult time approving this one. So.
Understand.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, just you don't have to go to item number 29. It's on the airport, but it just we're all looking for efficiencies. We're looking for places that will hurt less so that we can
Hurt less?
even on my birthday? I'm trying to think of what another word would be. We're looking for less hurtful cuts.
What kind of hurtful cuts is less doing?
I'm sorry, I'll stop, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I want to go to the airport.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So the airport has been spending a lot of money in Anchorage on planning, on designing a new runway that's very controversial that they've explained to the public they don't need with today's demand, but with forecast demand they may need, they may not need. And it's like may need, may not need. And it doesn't take that long to build a runway. If the administration were to go to the airport and say, just hold off on this. This is not a priority given what else is going on in the state. Would they pay the state a dividend, or does all the airport money somehow stay inside the airport?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, since the International Airport is an enterprise fund, I think I would need to defer to the department to talk through what that would look like. My understanding is the master plan that you're talking about was sort of a required document, and what they, kind of updating their annual plan, whether or not their intention is to move forward on that anytime certain. I think it would be a good idea to have the International Airport folks come in and talk to the committee about that.
Through the chair.
President.
It's just another problem I have. I know they. I would guess that they're spending millions of dollars on going through the community, holding meetings, talking about designs for a runway they may or may not need. And I just don't. I would hope the governor's office would look at whether or not that's a wise use of spending at this point, given the other priorities we have in the state. But I don't really know. I guess we've never really had a discussion about it. I don't know if they don't spend that money, if we can somehow get that money into the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd have to explore that further. But now, right at the moment, those funds, receipts from the International Airport funds are separate. They're a component of the general fund, but they're separate. So I may have someone from the Department of Transportation here that could try to answer more detail, or we could get someone from the International Airport to provide that to you, which might be the better thing at this moment.
All right, thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner. I'm on page 2, line 11, line 12. I also had questions on line 11, so I'll join my co-chair on that one. But on line 12, with this emergency flooding disaster, so last Monday when we hosted the commissioner to the Budget Finance Subcommittee overview for Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, obviously the avalanche and Thompson Pass near Valdez came up. And he says, I asked him, I said, are you going to be coming back for a supplemental on that? And he says, no, that's what we do. We fix roads. We take care of roads. When there's avalanches, we go in there and we clear the roads, and then we repair without having to come back for extra funds. why are we coming back for another $2.4 million in extra funds when the department commissioner says this is what we do, that we're built in there? And it was based on the fact that some years they do more, some years is less, and he says, but they all even out. He says, and we've built into our budget the ability to have that flexibility. So I'm questioning why they came back on this one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, of course I would defer to Commissioner Camp on his what he's able to accommodate within his existing budget for things like an avalanche that would could be part of their regular M&O budget. These, I think if you look at the list of the items that are included, you know, there were some significant repairs needed for, you know, specifically Ammonic. There was a big chunk of the runway that washed away and the road coming up to the airport. So I think those would be, you know, above and beyond what their regular M&O budget would do. So I think the conversation would really need to be with Commissioner Kemp about what he can accommodate within his M&O budget and these kinds of.
Mr. Chair, we will.
There is a representative from DOT if you would like to have them come up. Mary?
Through the Chair, my name is Mary Sorokin. I'm the Admin Service Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Representative Newman, Commissioner Kemp was talking about his operating budget needs, and this is a capital budget request for the funding to do that, to do the actual repairs as opposed to paying for the staff who, you know, might be doing the repairs. This is a capital budget, and I believe, as Commissioner Kemp said, you know, by and large, he works very hard to not have to come forward for operating budget supplementals, because what we do is we do clear avalanches, and we do, you know, patch potholes, but when there are big capital expenditures, we do come forward.
I'll discuss it with the Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gurr, do you want to ask your question now? We have DOT up.
I do. Thank you. Hi, Mary. Actually, it's two questions. Sorry you're here, but because I have a second one. The first one is what I asked before. If we were able to get the airport just to put a hold on this airport expansion in Anchorage, is that money that will be saved that we could then have in the general fund for what we might deem higher priority projects?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, it's my understanding that the Federal Aviation Administration requires that what revenue we generate from the airport has to be spent at the airport, or in this case, the international airport system. So I believe that all the revenue that we generate, which is what we are spending, because we spend our international airport revenue funds to operate the airport, I believe they have to stay with the airport. They might not have to be spent on that activity.
Through the Chair. Does the state not support the airport at all with any general funds?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, no.
Thank you. Just one other question while we have the department here.
Go ahead.
Mr. Rookie, this is really for your management to deal with, because we can't go into the Department of Transportation and redo things. But I hear stories from employees about doing projects within a fiscal year, not because they need to be done, but so that they get to use the budget money, because the budget money might otherwise disappear. And I've heard those stories from employees more than once. Do you ever scour through the department to see whether or not you are spending money on things that don't need to be spent, just in order to spend money that was appropriated through the general fund, so you don't have to give it back the next year?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, I know that is one of Commissioner Kemp's high priorities, is to make sure that he has the ability to look at projects and to make sure that there are what in our world we call shelf-ready projects, so that you can always spend whatever funding, whether it be general fund or federal fund, on the highest need.
Chair, that almost sounded like a yes to my question. I guess, are you cognizant of not spending money that's been appropriated on projects that are not high priorities, so that maybe you just don't use the whole general fund appropriation that's been given to you in a particular year?
Representative Bureau, I'm a little confused on the question myself, but if I understand correctly, I think that the legislature has given DOT the authority to transfer funds, unused funds, from one project to another project without coming back to the legislature. I mean, is that kind of the stuff you're talking about?
Through the chair, no. The concerns I've heard more than once through more than one employee is that projects are being completed that they don't necessarily need to have completed just to make sure they spend the available general fund money that's there. I just want to
You're talking about priorities.
I'm talking about spending money just because it's there, as opposed to spending money because it needs to be spent.
I believe the department always tries to spend its money as wisely as possible, and I am sure that in any organization of 3,500 people, there are people who might not consider one thing the same priority as another person might think that is.
I don't know how to go about it other than being employed by DOT and looking and going through it. So I don't know what else to ask, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this actually sounds like a good conversation for tomorrow's Department of Transportation overview. And mine's more of a comment than a question along that. Being the representative who has the Anchorage International Airport in her district, and having my friend, Representative Costello, who had it before me, I applaud the airport for taking the time to reach out to the community. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they don't spend the money and go out to the community to make sure they're getting the input, then they'd be in even bigger trouble. So I just want to clarify, there is no airport expansion at this point. There's a master plan that says if and when down the line there's a need for it, this is where we would do it and how we would do it. But I want to be very clear, because, standing up for my neck of the woods, things about any potential expansion, new runways, reallocating, the Coastal Trail is not going away. It will not go away under my watch or Representative Costello's watch. And this is an if, when, maybe, and lots and lots and lots of discussion at this level, at the community level, would happen. So I just want to make sure it's clear that when we're talking about airport expansion, there's not a new runway on the horizon that's going to kind of leap out. So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Karen, my question has to do with fire suppression. And are you aware of other states perhaps addressing the need for fire suppression? It just seems like we can't really anticipate what the draw will be every year. And I know the department budgets a certain amount, but we often come back in a supplemental. And is there any other way that you recommend that we pay for this portion of our budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Costello, we know that all Western states, particularly, who've been struggling with wildfires, significant fire seasons over the past several years, are wrestling with the same issues that we are. Clearly, there are different decisions we could make about how much we would like to include in the base operating budget for both mitigation activities and fire suppression. I mean, that is a discussion we could have. At this point, and particularly in this current environment, we are not proposing to change the base amount for fire suppression and to continue to use the process that we've had in place when the fire seasons occur, keeping the legislature informed of those fires and those expenditures and the opportunity to come back. But there are other approaches. Should you want to consider those?
Anybody else has any further questions? Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, and this might be a question for you, I'm not sure. So on the ratifications, because for like the Department of Labor, it's $281,000 of mistakes, because I just read all four of them. If I make a mistake in my home, then I have to pay it off maybe in several installments. Do we have that option to where maybe we don't want to ratify the whole $281,000 because the department should have maybe not let it go? Or can it come out of the governor's budget? I mean, does it have to come out of that department? Who has, I guess, the most oversight, the department commissioner or the governor? Because that's a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman?
I don't think that I'm good to be able to answer that question, so I'll defer to
I didn't know whether it was a call that you
OMB director.
Well, this guy is almost God.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, these items actually have already occurred. They occurred in the fiscal year that is reflected in the backup for those particular items. So there's no additional general fund that you're approving in the current year for these items. That already occurred several years ago, depending on the fiscal year. So what we're asking for is basically the transaction that will zero balance and, you know, zero out the books on it. The errors, either the under-collection, disallowed costs, whatever the circumstances were that resulted in the ratification has already occurred.
Okay, I'm going to make one shot, and then I'll probably come see you instead. So it's already been paid, is what I'm understanding you to say. Was it paid out of the department, or was it paid through some other supplemental? We just didn't know it was a mistake at the time. I mean, how did it get paid for if just now we know what the amounts are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, it was basically an over expenditure that was not known. If we had known about them in time to bring them forward as a supplemental, we most likely would have brought them forward for your consideration in a supplemental. Some of these, particularly with federal programs, some of those closeouts don't occur in time. These are kind of accounting transactions that are like I said, have already occurred. And unfortunately, there are a few of them here that we need to bring forward to zero balance these old accounts.
In layman's terms, we are the government, and we write our own check.
We can wipe out somebody's debt?
And Mr. Chairman, I can put it in even better layman's terms. It's kind of like the bartender that calls up the owner and asks if the customer there is good for a couple of rounds of drinks, and the owner asks if he's already ordered them, and he said, yes, then he is. And right now, that's where we are. The drinks have already been ordered.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I was just looking for where's the accountability. If we can just wipe it out, I wish I had the same thing. But I guess that's for another day for a different kind of process.
Seeing no further comments or questions. Thank you, Ms. Rehfeldt. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Rehfeldt. You can get away from us here right now.
All the drinks have already been ordered.
Yeah.
All right, next up we have the Department of Law on their overview for the budget.
McHugh, are you doing the law department?
No,
I'm going to go to the shirt seat.
I know. Excuse me.
We'll stand at ease for a half a second here. Finance Committee back to order. It's 2:25. And now before us is the Attorney General, and we will have the overview for the Department of Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Garrity. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Alaska. I appreciate this opportunity to present the overview to the committee. We divide our services and our mission, if you will, into these four core areas: protecting Alaskans, fostering conditions for responsible development of our natural resources, protecting the fiscal integrity of the state, and promoting good governments. And I didn't, those were established before I assumed this position. I think I have no reason or need to change them. I think they state the mission of the Department of Law very well. The criminal division is housed in 13 offices around the state. The civil division is divided into 14 sections, if you will, and the civil division is itself shares criminal offices in seven locations around the state, but the bulk of the civil division, of course, is in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. This shows our FY15 operating budget request. We're going to be taking a reduction this year of about 3.6%, or about 5%, I should say, of our general funds. And it shows how that's broken down and where the changes are compared to FY14. This shows our percentage of funding from the various sources, federal receipts, other state funds, which is interagency payments and receipts, or RSAs, as we call them, between law and the various agencies we represent, designated general funds, and unrestricted GF. The federal funds have just about disappeared. The amount that's shown there is about $1 million for Medicaid fraud, which the federal government funds. And I'll get into that in a minute, and maybe some of you have heard the presentation in the last couple of days by the head of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. But in any event, I'll touch on that later. But as this is, the federal receipts have just about disappeared, and that's the only amount we get now is for Medicaid fraud. Shows the personnel reductions that we're going to be that we have planned. It doesn't say that here, but overall, the bulk of the change we're going to be making, Mr. Chairman, is losing seven positions: six attorneys and one law office assistant. The six attorneys are divided between our criminal and our civil division. Three of the positions are currently vacant. And so with the other three will be done through attrition, retirement, and so on. We don't plan to, to lay anybody off, but we will be reducing by those number of positions, and we're just going to do more with less is the plan. I view us as one big Department of Law. We are divided into criminal and civil, and we have all these civil sections. We're all lawyers, criminal law, criminal procedure in law school. I wouldn't throw somebody from the environmental section into trying a felony, for example, but otherwise I do expect us to, what I call cross-pollinate a little bit. I mean, if we need to help out, someone from another section has got an ebb in their practice or their caseload, then we're going to help out. I don't think there's anything wrong with pushing people outside their comfort zone just a little. I think variety's good. I think we have a lot of young attorneys who do want to do more and have the energy and have the ambition, and they like to work in a variety of cases. So, for example, this last year we had the criminal cases going on in Bethel with there's 22 fishermen there who were contesting their citations for taking king salmon during the closure, and there were constitutional issues raised about freedom of religion and subsistence and so on, and we very important issues, complex issues, and we drafted some attorneys from our opinions, appeals, and ethics section to help out, work with the briefing. One of them actually went to Bethel and assisted with the trial to help make a record and so on, and we obtained the convictions and the case is now on appeal. But that's what I'm talking about, is when we need to help in one place, we're going to, you know, draw on the pool of talent we have, and we have a very talented pool. So, you know, we're going to do the best we can, but the plan is to do more with less, and if I could put it as succinctly as I can, with these six attorney positions it will be reduced by. This shows the our budget as a percentage of the state operating budget. Quite the order ahead, but you know, as you can see, we've fluctuated from about a low of 1.1% in fiscal year 2008 to about 1.5 in FY 2012. We're now at 1.2, and the fluctuations really, I mean, we've actually been pretty stable, if I may say. The fluctuations have been really on our outside counsel contracts. We had a blip associated with a BP corrosion case, for example. We're using outside counsel for that arbitration. The TAPS tariff cases are another example where, you know, we have significant outside counsel needs. For the upcoming year, as I get to, we're going to have significant needs for the gas line outside counsel contract and the services associated with that. So the spending level has been, in terms of a percentage of the total agency funding, has been pretty stable.
Mr. Chair? I'm sorry to ask, but we've seen this chart from every agency, and I can never figure out what the purple line is. And I'm just can I ask for clarification just so I can understand the chart? Mr. Garrity, so just in the most recent fiscal year, 1.2% of the agents of the total operating budget, that's the red line. What's the purple line?
That's a good question, Representative Garland.
Are you serious?
This was given to me, I think it was provided by OMB, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm happy to ask if you know.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
I think you're backwards. Blue line is the first one.
I just see.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dave Blaisdell, the Admin Service Director for the Department of Law. The red line actually represents
the red line is your 1.2% of the total. No.
And 1.2% is the blue line as it goes through, and it represents the percentage of law's budget to the total state agencies.
Thanks. I just saw the number on the red bar, but it should be on the purple bar. Got it.
We both learned something.
Continue.
This, again, shows the budget growth compared to our 10-year plan for all funds. And, again, it's a pretty relatively flat. It's going to be flatter than it's depicted here in our 10-year plan because we are reducing our budget. And the line would be straighter than it is, except for, as I said, the blips we've associated with these larger cases when we have to retain outside counsel, BP corrosion, and so on. This shows essentially the same thing, I believe, except just looking at the GF funds only, which is the most significant portion of our funding. I'm assuming this is similar to other city agencies. We're personal services and our people their intellectual power and so on. That's what we do. That's what we use. That's our stock and trade. Contractual refers to outside counsel, experts, consultants, other people that we work with and use. And again, this shows the adjustments to the FY 14 management plan get to the base. We don't have a continuing outside counsel contract, so those are removed every year and reinserted through this process, you know, when they're justified and when the committee hears the testimony and hears the need and so on. So those are removed, those one-time items. Statewide items are added back in, like health insurance, salary increases, and so on. Get to your adjusted base. And then this shows the increments that have been added back in and the deletion of the seven positions. Of course, positions added last year were just at the 75% level, so there's a line item there for full funding of those positions. Reduced expenditure levels are going to come through things like our outside counsel contracts. It's my intent to try to do more with less with respect to those contracts as well. I think we could do more in-house, and we're going to. We're not going to be penny-wise and pound-foolish about it, but I'm a great believer in the talent level in the department, and we need to utilize it more and get as much out of it as we can, and we're going to tighten our belt in terms of outside counsel use, I think. We're going to better manage our vacancy rate and try to look at those positions when they become open, somebody retires, waiting as long as we can to fill them, and things like that. Anything else in there? The one position through an RSA that's being funded by corrections is an attorney to handle corrections claims. We had a tremendous influx of those claims last year. It's an enormous caseload. We've got two attorneys doing it. We had two attorneys doing it, and the corrections wasn't paying for a portion. We had no RSA with corrections. When the Goose Creek prison opened, of course, all the prisoners are, I don't know if they've all been returned. They're certainly in the process of being returned, and the prison is up and open and up and running, and maybe, I don't know how populated it is, but it's going to be populated fully very soon if it's not already. But prisoner claims used to be handled by the contractor who was housing those prisoners in the lower 48. And they're now returning to Alaska, and those prisoner claims, and they've got nothing but time on their hands. They're now the responsibility of the state, and so we've seen a big increase in those. And that's another example, if I can digress just for a minute, where we had tremendous influx of claims. The attorneys came to us and just, and these attorneys have to advise corrections as well. They need advice and ongoing consultations on, regular business regulations, policies, and so on. So the number of claims has made it difficult for them to provide that advice. So we took attorneys from other sections, transportation, other sections, and we farmed out, carefully went through the caseload. We won't give somebody, something terribly complex, obviously, to handle, but we took those claims and we farmed them out amongst the other sections to experienced litigators, people who know what they're doing. But, again, that's the type of the fill-in, if you will, that we will do and we'll need to do. And we did it this last year in a couple, two, three areas. So. But we, working with corrections and OMB, we were able to get this RSA to fund another attorney to handle the corrections work, which is sorely needed. This breaks out the budget, if you will, amongst our four core services that I described earlier. There's a certain amount of discretion involved in how you allocate these areas because, for example, consumer protection, we put that in protecting Alaskans, but some of the other sections in the civil division, we just have to use our judgment in divvying those up and allocating them to our core services. But I think this is a fair estimation and summary of how that breaks out for the FY budget. And this shows it by the numbers, if you will. There is a return on investment, if you will. The BP corrosion, for example, the arbitration award was $255 million to the state. We have other cases ongoing, a lot of pharma cases. There were in class actions with other states. And these cases settle, and we keep track of them. Oil, gas, and mining settles a number of cases, tariff cases, tax cases, and so on. The Fast Ferry case we settled last year, and not for cash, but for some new engines, a very valuable settlement for the state. Consumer Protection, as I said, settles a number of cases. Our regulatory section that deals with public, protects the public, if you will. I mean, they last year reduced requested rate increases from the utilities here in South Central Alaska and elsewhere. And they're really the only entity that protects the public interest in these RCA proceedings. But there's over $6 million in requested rate increases that did not pass through to consumers because RAP has successfully contested the legitimacy of the cost or the charge or whatever the utility was seeking to pass on. And I just want to touch on some individual topics, if I will. As I said, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, when I became AG and was looking at the various things we were doing, I was not satisfied that we were doing enough with this unit. And we had, or concentrating the right types of cases, between 2010 and 2012, we'd had six convictions. Since October 2012, when we did a shakeup, major shakeup in the unit, and got a good young prosecutor is in charge of the unit by the name of Andrew Peterson. I want to give him credit. But since October 2012, we've had 72 cases charged in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. We've had 44 convictions. We've got restitution judgments in excess of $225,000. We've got 21 cases pending still. And restitution in those cases, we estimate, will be somewhere between $1 and $3 million. In addition, when we receive credible evidence of fraud, and we work closely with DHSS, or this unit works closely with DHSS, we will suspend a medical provider, or Medicaid provider, I should say, and we've suspended many additional people who were receiving money from Medicaid, but based upon his incredible suspicions of fraud, DHSS has a basis to suspend payments to them, and DHSS has estimated it'll save the state about $15 million. So, again, I want to give Andrew a lot of credit, but this unit's been a real turnaround and very successful and one of our bright spots. Last summer, I instituted a change in our plea negotiation policy, which essentially for about 20% of the cases that we handle, the criminal cases, and it's the more serious cases, felonies, serious crimes, domestic violence, it eliminates the ability of the prosecutor and the defense attorney to agree on the sentence and the disposition of the case. Those cases sentencing will have to be done by a judge. I think it's been a success thus far. I mean, it's not one of these policies that you, I guess, judge by success or not. My belief is that in order for the public to have confidence in the criminal justice system, it's important for them to see serious crimes dealt with by the court and by a judge and not by a private, an agreement, if you will, a negotiated plea between the prosecutor and the defense attorney. So. That was why I did the policy. We continue to look at it, to evaluate it. In the last 3 weeks, I've met with all the prosecutors in the state here in Anchorage, got feedback from them. I met with the this week, I met, spent an hour with the Office of Victim Rights and got a lot of input from Ms. Winston, good comments, good input. I met with the criminal court judges in Anchorage this week as well. I met with the criminal court judges, all the judges in Kenai handle criminal cases, but I met with them a couple weeks ago. And I'll be meeting with the, I'm going to head out to Palmer and go to Fairbanks at some point, too, and get input from them. So it's a policy. We're still looking at it. We've heard some good comments. We may tweak it a bit, but we're not going to abandon it. But we are going to try to make it more user-friendly based upon the input that we've received. And of course, it does and could have an impact on the court system, and that's why I'm soliciting their input as well. I assume members have heard about the backlog of appeals, or perhaps they haven't, but there is the Criminal Court of Criminal Appeals. There's been a significant backlog of appeals building up over the course of several years. And now, between the time a notice of appeal is filed and the briefing is completed, it's something like in excess of 500 days. Just incredible. And the Court of Criminal Appeals has come out with some guidelines on how they intend to reduce that backlog, and it's going to impact both the public defenders and OPA as well as the Department of Law. And so that's on the horizon. I guess the policy is in effect right now. And, you know, we're going to deal with it. We're going to cope with it. As I said, everybody, when they went to law school, at least I did, took criminal procedure and criminal law. And many of these appeals are sentence appeals. I think they're appeals that can be handled by a civil attorney, which is, again, not giving them the most complex appeals or anything like that. But again, the affirmation rate on these appeals is very high. And so we're going to – that's another area we may be challenged. But, again, we're going to do what we – do more with what we have. The decision, the Shelby County case, was issued last year. And the state – actually, before Shelby County was decided, we had filed a case in Washington, D.C., challenging the same provision – that was under attack in Shelby County, which was the coverage formula that roped Alaska and a number of other jurisdictions into pre-clearing all their election changes before they could be implemented, whether it's a precinct change or whatever. It didn't matter how minor. They had to be cleared by the Department of Justice. We challenged that. We felt strongly did not belong did not deserve to receive that scrutiny. And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed in Shelby County. Our case was subsequently dismissed by stipulation, with the Department of Justice agreeing that we were obviously no longer covered by the preclearance requirements. The National Association of Attorney Generals awarded the Department of Law an award for best brief last year, 2013, at their summer meeting in Boston. I didn't write the brief. My name's on it, but it was an excellent brief, and I think a credit to the department for their effort in the brief. And it was an amicus brief on the merits before the U.S. Supreme Court. So the effort was recognized by NAG, and credit to the attorneys involved. But for those interested, Senator Leahy and Representative Sensenbrenner have introduced matching bills in the House and the Senate to replace the coverage formula that was struck down in Shelby County. It does not include Alaska. I don't know where the bill is going to go, but the bill as written does not include Alaska. The Katie John case is, we filed our petition for certiorari in early November, a few months ago. It's still being briefed. I don't want to get into too much detail about it, except I'd point out that an amicus brief was filed by 14 states in support of Alaska's petition for certiorari. States like the brief was actually drafted by Colorado. It's got a Democratic governor. Oregon joined the brief. New Mexico has got a Democratic governor, Democratic AG. So I think it speaks something about the merits of the case and the issue about the federal authority and its encroachment on state rights. Those states they're not anti-subsistence states, obviously. That's not the issue for them. The issue is encroachment on state authority by the use of these in this case, the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine. So, again, we're very pleased with the support that was offered by those states. And Endangered Species Act, again, this is something we mentioned every year, there's a number of different species implicated. The major ones are the polar bear, and the polar bear is now covered by the act. We did lose that case. However, the next shoe that has to drop is the critical habitat, and we did win that case before the district court. The critical habitat established by NIFS covered 187,000 square miles of Alaska, and again, that rule was set aside by the district court here. It's currently on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Another case of some importance is the bearded seal case that was filed by last year, but the state did not file first. We joined some other plaintiffs who challenged the bearded seal designation. The bearded seal endangered species designation is based on a 100-year model. In other words, NIMS is trying to predict what will happen to that species, which is perfectly healthy and abundant right now, based upon climate change and what might happen in 100 years. So the state and some other groups are challenging that designation, and we look forward to a decision this year. The final one is the Stellar Sea Lion, which, again, we lost before the Ninth Circuit, the state and other industry groups. We're now waiting for a new environmental impact statement to be prepared by NIMS, and then we will be, that litigation may very well resume. But those are the three major ones. Again, there's a number of, a host of these cases pending and issues. This continues to be an ongoing issue as well, Alaskans' right to access and manage their land. The Sturgeon case, you're all familiar with, filed by Mr. Sturgeon, who was prohibited from using his hovercraft inside the Yukon and Charlie River Preserve. We had a setback with the U.S. District Court. Again, these are legal rulings, not factual. It's based on the law, but we are appealing that case along with Mr. Sturgeon. RS-2477 cases, we have the major ones pending in Chicken, but we've had a number of others as well, most of those with private entities. But the U.S. District Court issued a ruling adverse to the state in the Chicken case, which is a major one we have pending, and invited us to appeal, basically, because he thought it was a legal issue that needed clarification. So we're appealing that as well. We continue to litigate the roadless rule. We believe there was a settlement which exempted Alaska from the application of that rule in the Tongass. CD5 has to do with the environmental impact statement that was prepared for the NPRA for ConocoPhillips development up there on the bridge across the Colville River and so on. That case is pending. Motions for summary judgment have just been prepared and are ripe. And then very recently, the lease sale 193, which was the Shells and the Chukchi, the Ninth Circuit in a 2-1 decision decided that the environmental impact statement in considering was wrong to do its analysis based upon a 1 billion barrel of potential recovery scenario, and that number was somehow arbitrary and capricious. The dissenting judge disagreed and said this was clearly within the expertise of BOEM, the federal agency that was charged with doing the environmental impact statement. So, in any event, the number of these cases are still ongoing. We're not always hooked up with other states, other industry groups, and so on. That continues to be a major area of focus. Consumer protection, I heard quite a bit since I took this position about the onboard port shopping promoters that are employed by the cruise lines that visit Alaska. A lot of complaints from the Southeast delegation about nefarious practices, unethical practices, disparaging local vendors who were not signed up for the program, for example, and things like that. We fought a lawsuit against them last year during the session and negotiated a consent decree with the three onboard promotion companies that serve the cruise lines that come to Alaska. And worked out as a consent decree, but it requires a lot of disclosure, videotape of the presentations they make to the customers, which they give to us and which we review. So we're surveilling them, but we're keeping a close eye on their compliance with the decree. For example, you know, telling people before you start giving your shopping program that I get paid if you buy the stuff from these companies that I'm promoting, in so many words. So, preventing them from disparaging local vendors and so on. So we're monitoring it, and we get feedback from the Southeast delegation, and we'll look forward to doing that. A couple other things are not as similar in the consumer protection field. One is the Linden Transportation and the Northland Services deal that was done down here. You know, we have an issue with, we don't have a ton of competition up here in any event, and when one competitor offers to buy another, it's something we scrutinize very carefully. Sometimes the FTC does as well. But in the Linden case, we looked at the deal very closely, and the company they were acquiring, they competed with, we didn't think it had an effect on competition except in Southeast. And so we negotiated the deal. These are willing parties. They were in good faith and worked out an arrangement to allow another competitor, Samson. The company's been around for 50 years, to fill the void. Negotiated lease terms, facilities, dock facilities, and so on and so forth. Items to make Samson a credible competitor. So credit to Linden, credit to Samson and Northland. It's a deal that was settled. I think October 1, the consent decree was signed by the judge. But we have these consent decrees last. I mean, this Linden deal, for example, is 4 years. So we will be watching that, monitoring, and making sure it's work, and making sure that there is competition and the public protected, public interest. The other one I've mentioned is the Hill Corp. They acquired Marathon's assets in Cook Inlet, and it ended up with approximately 80% market share in Cook Inlet. And that is one that the FTC looked at as well. And, again, good company, responsible company. They realized the implications. We negotiated a consent decree with them, which will last through the end of 2017. But it puts a cap on the prices that they can charge to utilities and customers here at Southeast, probably in South Central. And I don't know about you, I used to read articles here in the last year, 18 months, about looming shortages in Cook Inlet and looking at importing gas and so on. I mean, I think that's pretty much gone away, and utilities now have a steady supply here into the foreseeable future. And as I said, credit to Hill Corp for recognizing the issue and wanting to do the right thing. And I think Conoco is now reapplied for its export license as well. So anyway, I think that's another example of what we do in the consumer protection area. The we do have challenges, obviously. Those are that same. In 2011, we tried 130 cases in Anchorage. I'm just talking Anchorage now, combined civil and combined misdemeanor and felony, pardon me. In 2012, we tried 148, and in 2013, we tried 176. So, and this is consistent with what we've been hearing from the court system as well. The numbers may not exactly match up because people have different ways of measuring, you know, when it's a trial and whether you call the jury or some other time. But the point is that the same numbers are going up. In part, this has led to the crisis, if you will, at the Court of Appeals with the criminal appeal backlog. This is a substantial increase in trial and the number of trials. So, again, we're up to the challenge. We'll continue, but we'll see there's some fluctuation from year to year, but in the last 3 years there's been a marked increase, and so it's something we're watching very closely. We were very jammed up in Bethel. I think all the state offices have some challenges in western Alaska, but Bethel was, I went out there myself, looked at it, and was a, we just had to get more space. Through the cooperation of the Department of Corrections and the court system, we were able to take over some space the corrections had, and we're paying for the renovations to that space and additional rent and so on. It's not a huge amount of space, but we're going to be able to move three attorneys over there, probably from child protection, or two attorneys and the law office assistant, but and free up the DA's office for some more space. And so we've had that facility cost. We also moved to new offices in Fairbanks, which are closer to the courthouse, and entered into a long-term lease there. But again, the Fairbanks office was a real security issue, and was on the, I'm going to the details of it, but it needed to be upgraded and needed to be moved, and that was accomplished last year as well. Nome is undergoing work, I don't think at our behest, but at the behest of other state agencies that occupy the facility there in Nome that we share. So we're going to be relocated for some months, the new space, but we do have some challenges with our facilities as well, though obviously we don't have nearly as many offices as many other agencies. I mentioned gas line funding. That's been, as everyone knows, very active over the last 6 months, and I predict it's going to remain very active in into the near future, and we have outside counsel working on that, but that is going to have to be increased, and I think it's going to be done through the bill. I'm not quite sure, but I just, as a heads up, that's an area that will is going to be very active in the foreseeable future. There's always elections issues. Always, I'm told that. I'm not sure. I lived through one, but that's going to be something we anticipate. The marijuana initiative that's on the ballot, I don't know where that's going to end up, but if it passes, we know from our from the experience and what we've learned from our colleagues in Colorado and Washington, but that'll be a major undertaking. There's many issues implicated by that initiative: licensing, food safety, tax receipts, and so on. Criminal laws will have to be modified. So, again, that's we're not going to get excited about it now, except that it's on the ballot, but that could pose or will pose some challenges as well if it passes. And again, effective use of outside counsel, I mentioned that earlier. We need to, I want to do a better job. I scrutinize all those contracts when requests are, when we receive, when I receive a request to increase the contract or supplement it, amend the contract, and before we let any contracts, I scrutinize those very carefully, and I'll continue to do so. But that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. Questions? And Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, General Garrity. And we've had conversations in the subcommittee as well, and appreciate that I've now gone into my 12th year on that subcommittee, and 2 years as a member. It's a lot easier just to be a member of the committee. And the subject of victims' rights, I just want to commend you on your diligence in following up on that issue and coordinating. You know, it's a lecture I've given to every incoming attorney general, and I probably applied a little heat on this, but there's never been a constitutional amendment that has had as much support as that. 178,885 people voted for that. No other amendment has even been close from back in 94, and it's one you were not singled out on that, but I really appreciate the diligence in knowing that the recognizing the when the voters amended Article 1, Section 12, and most importantly Section 24, that it really was a seminal moment for the rights of victims, and it's one that we have to continue to work to implement. And it's again, I was probably remiss in having a more detailed conversation with you, and I look forward to working with Ms. Taylor as well, because that's an important seat at this table when we're dealing with criminal justice issues. And I just really commend you, as you can deal with a lot of folks in state government that. It was that you immediately went over and talked to her. Thank you, and I think we're only going to go forward on this. And I think you're going to find that your and your staff can tell you they're a pretty good outfit to work with, and you have a lot of concomitants of issues. And I think foremost is that you're concerned about justice and the victim. So thank you for that.
Not at all, Mr. Chairman. I was one of those duh moments, frankly, when you brought it up. And Mr. Svobodny and I met with Taylor Monday or Tuesday for an hour. And she's a former prosecutor as well. So it was very insightful. There was things I had not thought of. And we're going to continue a dialogue with her. You were absolutely proper to bring it up with me and to remind me of it. And I appreciate it.
It's, you know, and it's a pretty savvy group of attorneys, and they're all women, and are about as tough and tenacious as I've ever dealt with. And I wouldn't want to be on the other end of a prosecutor for all those folks that are there, because they mean business on behalf of justice. I'd ask one question I should have asked every other commissioner. What is the relevance of telling us what percentage of the budget your department is? I just want to just elaborate. Commissioner Hardig even said, "Hey, 53 cents a day. I'm pretty happy with that." I'm sure he is. He's the commissioner. He's happy to pay that, or collective. We don't necessarily pay it directly, but I don't know if the people in Chicken on every given day of last year were happy with the 53 cents per person per day. But that's, and I'll let you answer the question. I'm sorry.
I think that slide was prepared for our use.
Yes.
But in fairness, I think it's useful to track what percentage of state budget an agency spends. But I think that's fair. But I don't know why it's used otherwise.
I think it's I know why it's used, because hey, it's only 2%, or it's only a cup of. I don't ever buy anything. I drink as much free coffee as here as I can. I got a lot of free coffee I give to people in my office. I can't choke down a $4 cup of coffee. I'm too cheap. But even if somebody buys it for me, that irritates me to say, "Oh, this is only the cup of this is only a cup of latte a day." And I think it diminishes the whole look at the budget, whether it's done at the local level or otherwise. And I know what it's done. It's say it's only 2%, and that's fine if there's not 48 or 50 other entities that only have 2% or some percentage.
Well, in fairness to the OMB, I think it's useful, it might be if I were to committee, to look at some of the same graphs for each agency if I have oversight.
Unless we want to compare to other departments and say, well, they got 4% or 6%, like we're just dealing with another bill. Right. And that creates a little, maybe a little bit of friction, potentially.
Let me enter. gain control again.
I'm sorry. You're restrained.
Oh, and I think what you'll find when we get if we dig into that a little bit, you'll find that one of the chairmen at one point in time thought that was a great piece of information for the legislature to have, and those I believe those charts that you're looking at actually come from our own legislative finance division. So if we don't necessarily want them as a group, then that's real easy to not have to have them.
They can be useful, Mr. Chairman. I just don't. I want to have them useful in the right end.
Sure, I understand.
And it does promote a better understanding of the budget. And by God, I'm a fan of that.
Yeah, I'm quite sure this commissioner did, or this AG did not implement.
I know he's quite positive. He's a solid. He's a hockey fan for one. And aren't you pretty excited? Chugiak beat Service the other night. Yeah. On a return of investment, it's real. You can figure, and I think you're six and a half to one might even be modest. Is there any way you can even give us a wag on what's our return on investment of what we stopped from happening to us and lost opportunities and things we never even got to calculate a value? Because there's a lot of criticism of the lawsuits, and we don't. If we lose one of those, and what opportunities we lose, we can't talk about an economic development issue for a community, or for our state, or for an industry.
Excellent point, Mr. Chairman. I mean, how do you value, a child rescued from a deteriorating family, or rescued from starvation, rescued from physical abuse, which we do, along with the Office of Children's Services. So, I mean. How do you put a price on the advice that we give the agencies we represent on a daily basis?
I think we do put a price, and it's all reflected.
Prevention is the pound of cure, and you don't see that. It's hard to quantify it, but I don't. I'm sure on occasion have saved some agency from taking a step that would have invited litigation and expense. So it's a very good point. It's hard to measure what we do in dollars. So prosecuting a rapist, some murder, there's just so many things it's just hard to quantify. But we do, there are straight monetary recoveries, obviously, that we pursue. And so those we do identify. But they're not going to, we're not going to have a BP corrosion case every year, obviously, or that kind of report every year.
Mr. Chair, in general, Garrity, I was really thinking of some of the federal litigation of what we have lost opportunity. And that's where I didn't draw the map quite as straight as I should have there for you.
Well, that too. I mean, I you're right. I mean, all those things, it's hard to put a dollar value on. So I would agree with that as well, Mr. Chair.
And I just want to make sure that Governor Martinez of New Mexico is noted as a Republican governor.
Is he?
She.
Pardon me.
She's a prominent Hispanic Republican national leader.
I think the AG is Democratic. I'm not.
Every state has its issues.
Yeah, I'm not saying the point is for me. We had broad, bipartisan support.
And Oregon, Kitzhaber and Hickenlooper from Colorado are Democrats. But I think your point was that we look beyond what's the issue is stereotyped as. There's much broader issues of concern to state and how the federal government intrudes upon management decisions, irrespective of party, is I think your point, though, right? Did I get that one right?
Stated it better than I did.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the limited indulgence you granted me.
Yeah. Thank you. We keep him around because of historical abilities. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Attorney General. Yesterday in the Budget Subcommittee for Department of Natural Resources, we heard a presentation from the head of the Alaska Minerals Commission, Mr. Bill Jeffress. And in his presentation, which we require annually from the legislature, he mentioned that one of the major challenges that they are facing, the mining industry, resource development industry faces, is federal overreach. And I was wondering if you could comment on your impression of the amount of time and energy and effort we spend addressing issues related to federal overreach.
Well, through the chair, Representative Costello, it's a lot. We've certainly been very involved in the Pebble controversy, for example. And again, I'm for or against the mine. I'm not a scientist or an engineer, but I am for due process, and I'm for the state being able to exercise the regulatory authority that we have, like any other state, over projects on state land. So that's one example that immediately comes to mind. The Sturgeon case, we challenged the federal authority. Our involvement in that case is where they required us to get a permit to land a helicopter on a gravel bar to do some fish sampling or biology, whatever. We shouldn't have to obtain a permit. We got the permit, but I mean those steps should not be necessary. So I think it would be hard to measure, but I certainly agree it's a constant battle something I never attempted to quantify the time we spend doing it. Some of it's a matter of interpretation, I think, and judgment, but it is a definite impact on our department as well in terms of us our conflicts with the federal government. And I might add, we're not alone. We are not alone. Other states have the same issues. Hence, 14 states joined our brief on the petition for certiorari because they're concerned about the same types of issues in a different context for their own state. So, we're not alone in that, and I think it's bipartisan, I think, and it's an issue everywhere, including Alaska.
A follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Costello.
Can you give us a short overview of the status of the RS-2477 issue?
The district court judge granted summary judgment to the native allotment holders that are involved in some of the trails in the Chicken area. And the precise number of trails escapes me right now, but it's the Chicken is a number of trails that have been established, been around for a long, long time. They're crisscrossed with native allotments as well as some private property interests. And, of course, all those parties have to be all those individuals and entities have to be parties when we move to quiet title in our RS-2477 trail. So The native allotment owners and TCC, who I think was just as an amicus or may have intervened, I forget now, Tenino Chiefs Conference, moved for summary judgment on the basis that, in essence, the native allotment trumped the state's RS-2477 claim, and furthermore, that the state could not condemn the native allotment either in order to not condemn the whole thing, but that portion of it that intersected our trail or interfered with the trail, just that portion of it, so we could have title to the entire trail. So the district court granted summary judgment to the allotment owners and TCC on that issue and said that he thought it was an issue that should be decided by the Ninth Circuit, and he immediately certified it for appeal. So the decision just came down, I think, last month or in December. So the appeal, I'm not sure it's even ripe yet or what the briefing schedule is, but that, in a nutshell, is what happened with that case.
Follow up?
Yes.
I actually was more interested in just a general overview of the number of RS-2477.
I think probably better than that is on Tuesday, I think this week, we have the Citizens Advisory Committee on Federal Areas, which is intimately involved in this trail issue. I'm sure that the general can come back, but those folks will know off the top of their head. So,
they are certainly very knowledgeable about it and involved as well as an advisory committee. The chicken claims are the main ones that the state has going on. We're involved in other limited cases that involve private landowners who claim, you know, we have one going that involves the Iditarod Trail, landowners claiming that, we're crossing their private property. Well, we're defending that on the basis, among other things, that that's an RS-2477 trail. So there's a lot of cases like that that we're involved in, but they're not the major cases. The major cases where we're trying to make inroads, Representative Costello, is the chicken case. So I'd be happy to discuss it with you some more privately or and confer with you or after the CAFCA meeting, but they might be able to shed more light on it. But the chicken is the main vehicle we have going.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Garrity. I want to talk about Medicaid fraud. Did I hear you say that you generally receive back recover back $1 to $3 million per year?
What I meant to say to the chair, Representative Newman, is that we receive judgments, restitution judgments. We've got judgments in hand in excess of $225,000. That's not cash. That's a judgment that says the person who built Medicaid owes us that money. We have 21 cases pending where the estimated amount of restitution available is between $1 and $3 million. And those cases are still pending. They haven't been reviewed. The FBI did an investigation, study in 2011, I believe, and they estimate 3 to 10% of all Medicaid fraud, or all Medicaid payments are fraudulent. And so in Alaska, I think we spent $1.5 billion last year on Medicaid payments. So, I'm not satisfied with the progress thus far, but I'm not completely satisfied with where we are yet, but I'm very satisfied with the progress that's been made just in 2 years.
So those recovered funds, where do they go?
Well, when we recover them, they would go back to DHSS, and I'm not sure what they do with them. But, they would go back to the Navy. At this point, we have judgments, and we have a number of cases pending, and I can go into more detail for you, Representative, but the point I want to make is that unit has cranked up significantly in the last 2 years and is one of our bright spots, and we're going to continue.
Just one more. I believe that you also said that the Department of Law with Medicaid fraud saves $15 million per year. Is that?
When we have credible evidence of fraud, DHSS will suspend payments to somebody who's billed them. So, as I said, the exact number is hard for me to quantify. I think it's scores, but it intermixes a little bit with the number of pending cases. We may have a pending case with evidence of fraud. We may have investigated that case and charged it. So I don't want to give the numbers are too much detail, I frankly don't know, but in those, where those payments have been suspended, those Medicaid, not recipients, but the people who provide should receive medical Medicaid payments, personal care assistance, transportation companies, doctors in some instances, the money that will be saved, according to DHS, from suspending payments for those in the system is $15 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Garrity. Just want you to know the attorneys between you and me are losing 2-0 to Representative Stoltz today. I had the state of Maine joining the union 40 years earlier than it really did, but I thought all Red Sox Nation states were the original colonies, so that's Mr. Garrity, there are just two areas.
That was funny.
There are just two areas where I'm just wondering whether we can obtain some cost savings. And these are difficult areas. It's really easy for all of us to pass bills that increase crimes because then we get to say we're tough on crime. And it's really hard for any of us to decrease sentences because then we get labeled weak on crime. Though if we all went in on it together, if there were consensus, that might help. So, the Commissioner of Corrections was here a few days ago, and he showed a graph, and he was pretty honest and blunt. The number of nonviolent criminals in the correction system is now, it's grown significantly. And he said that's because what we used to have as 0 to 1 year misdemeanors for nonviolent crimes are now becoming 1, 2, and 3 year crimes. And so I asked him, well, you know, and maybe there are very good reasons for us to have, I mean, we passed those bills. There, you can't just lump them all together and say it was a dumb idea on our part. But would you, I guess I would ask, would you work with the Commissioner of Corrections and the Governor and maybe come to us with a list of criminal sentences and things that we have changed from misdemeanors into felonies that are nonviolent crimes that maybe warrant a relook? Because his answer is that we're going to have to build a new prison soon, and you know, upping things from misdemeanors to felonies is often appropriate but doesn't come without a cost. So is there any way you could work with the commissioner and maybe identify some places where we overreached and might dial the sentences or the level of crime back a little bit for the nonviolent ones?
Well, it's a fair question, Representative Garrett, through the chair. I defer to Commissioner Schmidt in terms of his testimony, his assessment. I think, you know, there's many dimensions to the problem of why people are in prison, obviously. You mentioned one, which is the original sentences they received. The other is recidivism. And people, and I think Chief Justice Carpinetti a couple of years ago did a State of the Judiciary speech, which was, he apologized in advance because it was going to be so dense and dull, but I listened to it. I was in the audience, and it really was insightful. I mean, there's studies have shown that there's about one-third of criminal defendants sentenced that will probably never reoffend. You don't have to do anything with them. They've learned their lesson, and whatever the crime was, they're not going to reoffend. There's another third that will probably reoffend regardless of what you do, and no matter how much money you spend. And there's that third in the middle that are kind of on the fence. And so I think trying to – I know Commissioner Schmidt's aware of this. I mean, trying to do risk assessments of these people in the system to try to determine you've got a fixed amount of money for rehabilitation and programs and so on. Where should we invest those dollars to get the biggest bang for the buck? So – I mean, there's a number of dimensions of it, and I think you mentioned one. I'd be happy to take a look at it and work with Mr. Svobodny, and I think there's some bills pending, I believe, that kind of touch on this issue as well. So I'd be very interested to see, you know, how the legislature deals with it, and I applaud, you know, your interest in it. It's an important subject.
Through the chair. It's just, asking the question is not going to get me anywhere. I'm not, it seems like there is a substantial increase in the prison population of nonviolent criminals, and I guess I really would like you to take a hard look with the Commissioner of Corrections and say, well, maybe this should not be a felony, or maybe this should be a Class B, not a Class A. Mm-hmm. So we can take a look at it as policymakers, because otherwise we're just going to be building more prisons. So I would just ask you to do that. I can't make you do that.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'll certainly take a look at it, Representative Gara. I mean, I think it's a fair question, and I'll follow up. I'm sorry, I missed Commissioner Schmidt's presentation, and I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a number of crimes where we can look at sentences or classifications and make recommendations. So,
thanks. And then just along the same line, Mr. Chair, on a slightly separate subject. You have your plea policy, and we certainly don't want folks who've committed terrible crimes getting off easy, right? That was the original concern a number of years ago. You know, we were concerned that rapists were getting off with plea bargains, or domestic violence assailants were getting off with very easy plea bargains. But I just want to make sure your plea policy isn't something that's costing us too much. So your plea policy, if the assistant district attorney finds that they had overcharged, you're not taking away their discretion to adjust the charge to where they feel it should be. What your plea policy is that they can't agree to a sentence. They have to go, once they agree to the charge, they have to then go to court to have the sentence determined?
Well, they can't drop it down two levels. They do have some discretion, but in terms of dropping it down more than one level, you know, I think they need to go to their supervisor. And there are exceptions to the policy, and there are exceptions that come up, Representative Gar. And so, you know, the policy allows for exceptions and for individual case reviews where the prosecutor believes a two-level drop is appropriate. But that type of routine drop, no, we don't permit two-level drops. He does have discretion to drop it down one level. If he thinks that's the appropriate disposition, and then if the defendant agrees, I'll go to open sentencing.
Through the chair.
Okay.
Well, the dropping, well, as long as there's something that says you can drop it two levels if the person didn't really commit the crime, and what if they didn't commit the crime? I mean, then you just, they're.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're not going to go to trial with cases that, you know, shouldn't go to trial. And if the person didn't commit the crime, then obviously they're not, you know, that's a different circumstance. I'm talking about people where the person's been charged, and we shouldn't be afraid of going to trial. I mean, I've told my prosecutor, I spoke at the prosecutor conferences, you know, you go to trial, give it your best shot. It's an acquittal. You know, that's the system. Some people are acquitted, and that's the way it works, and I think the public expects us to try the difficult cases and the hard cases. And when you enter into a plea agreement and somebody reads about it in the paper and the judge approves it, I just think the newspapers and the media, this is no fault of their own, but they never can report on really what happened and all the circumstances. And I think many of those do a disservice to the justice system unintentionally. And it's unfair because thousands of cases are properly disposed of every year, and it's just the few, as you know, to get that notoriety, and I think they really do damage beyond just that one case. So, you know, we look at it carefully, and we're tweaking it. We're taking a look. I got feedback from the DAs. They want some additional discretion. We're management's taking a look at it, and there's been some good suggestions, and we're considering them, and there will be changes, and we're talking to victims' rights, and they're interested in certainty, for example. I mean, a case that goes to open sentence and can be appealed, the victim doesn't get certainty. I mean, we heard some valuable insight from the Office of Victim Rights, so we're sifting through all this information, and we'll be making appropriate changes. But for the certain category of crimes to which it applies, there's not going to be that kind of free and open discretion.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Representative Holmes, did you have questions? Representative Munoz.
Thank you, General Garrity. It's a pleasure to see you. Congratulations on your department's successes. It was a very interesting presentation. I want to personally thank you for your responsiveness to our issues with the onboard marketing programs, and let you know that we've heard from many businesses in the region that have seen a real positive result in their business environment and their ability to, you know, to provide the services that they do. So I wanted to communicate my thanks to you and working with us on that. And also thank you for your work on continuing to pursue the roadless issue in Southeast. It's particularly a big issue for us. It affects everything from mining access to energy developments, and really appreciate your department's work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Munoz.
Okay, Mr. AG, we're out of time, and I appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate candidness with us today.
And all of our insightful questions.
And all our insightful questions. Oh, and your insightful questions. So that'll end our agenda for today. Tomorrow at 1:30, we will then take up the governor's budget overview with the Department of Transportation, and they'll have get ready for them, and then the Department of Public Safety.
A lot of that other way today.
So with that, we are adjourned.